First, have you ever thought about what scientific things are going on when you plop a couple steaks on the grill? Have you ever wondered why certain cuts of meat taste better and cook differently than others? Our next guest may have some answers for us. Dr. Stuart Faramond joins us now. He's a food scientist, and his new book is called The Science of Cooking: Every Question Answered to Perfect Your Cooking. Dr. Stu, thanks a lot for joining us today.
A pleasure.
Well, first, tell us a little bit about your background. How did you get into the world of food science?
I have quite a unique story, I would say. I was originally a medical doctor about 10 years ago, and I was diagnosed with a brain tumor at the time, and that forced me to leave medicine. So I then went into, it's a malignant brain tumor, and it was completely removed with the operation. It left me with epilepsy. Which meant that I couldn't go back to medicine because there was a danger of me having seizures whilst I was working. So I left the medical profession, went into teaching, and then from teaching went into freelance science writing and science communication, and kind of fell into food research and food science. And so I guess nearly a decade on, I've got around to writing a book.
And your book covers the science of a lot of different kinds of food. We're going to talk about meat in particular today, but talk about just how much science can go into how we cook and how we can make better food.
Oh, it's huge. Absolutely huge, Rob. I think we do cooking a disservice when we just pick up a recipe book and follow it. Because before our eyes, when we're cooking, when we're getting something ready to eat, there's some incredible things going on. And it's not just an academic thing of, oh, isn't it nice to know that there's chemical reactions going on, or why when I beat this egg white, it turns into this kind of this fluffy white meringue thing. But if you understand it, you can actually cook better. And you realize that a lot of things that you read about in the cookery books and you see that TV chefs do aren't actually always that right. So it's a really empowering thing, and it also will give you ideas to be more creative and try new stuff.
You mentioned chemical reactions in cooking, and that takes us to meat and this thing. I've heard of it before. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, the Maillard reaction.
Yeah, you can say it however you want to say it.
How should I say it?
Tomato, tomato. I'm not Maillard reaction. M-A-L-L. M-A-I-L-L-A-R-D, Maillard reaction. It's the thing that gives meat its flavor. It's also called the Browning reaction, although if you just call it the Browning reaction, it does it a disservice, because it's not just about turning something brown. It's about giving flavor. If you cook something, when you cook meat, say you put it on a grill or something, and it gets that brown kind of crust going on, that's the Maillard reaction taking place. And it happens between about 218, 320 degrees Fahrenheit. And what's happening is the proteins that are in the meat itself, they're breaking down, and they're reacting with sugars. There's molecules of sugar within every single cell, and they react. And these two things, which are quite tasteless, come together to react to these countless different ways, and you get all these flavors come out. You get meaty, kind of caramelly flavors, and nutty flavors. The reason why caramel tastes like caramel is because of the Maillard reaction. You need to harness the Maillard reaction if you want your meat to taste like meat.
And we don't want to undercook meat, because that's hazardous. We hit that sweet spot with the Maillard reaction. My curse is the overcooking of meat. What happens to that delicious flavor when we let it cook too hot or too long?
Well, you can obviously have a steak that's rare in the middle. The main thing is that you get the outside seared, so that you get that meatiness on the outside. And if you like, if you've got a tender cut of meat and you want it to be served rare or medium rare, then that's okay, because you're getting that very smooth texture on the inside. So you definitely want the outside seared. But when you're overcooking it, the thing you've got to bear in mind is that the meat, and most of it, the cuts that we buy is muscle, but that is 75% to 85% water. So it's essentially a big bag of water that's just kind of held together. And so when you're cooking, you want to preserve as much of that moisture as possible. But obviously, the longer you cook it, the more of that moisture that you lose. And even if you cook it in water, then it will still dry out, because what's happening is muscle is made up of millions and millions of hair thickness strands of these muscle fibers. They're individual cells and they've got water in them, but as you cook it, they shrivel up and that water gets kind of squeezed out, a bit like if you've got a sponge and it's got water in it and you squeeze it and all the water comes out. So when you overcook it, you've essentially caused it to shrivel up, all those cells to kind of shrivel up together, all the moisture comes out, and you end up with this kind of bland, tasteless hunk of leather left over.
And Dr. Stu, you write about how to recover that hunk of leather. Is there anything we could do to save that overcooked meat?
Well, it's a bit like if you've added too much salt to a dish. You can't really undo it, but you can do things to kind of make the best of a bad situation. So when the one time when we do overcook meat is when we're doing slow cooking, if we're doing stews or casseroles, and we do that with the chewy cuts of meat, kind of like your chuck and your things like that. And that's because they've got lots of a thing called connective tissue in. Meat itself, you've got the muscle, you've got the fat, and then you've got this thing called connective tissue, which is the white stringy stuff that you get going through it. And that's really difficult to chew. It's really difficult to digest. But if you cook meat slowly, then that connective tissue breaks down into a thing called gelatin, which is the same thing that makes jello wobbly and set. And that gives slow cooked meat this kind of this unctuous, velvety kind of flavor, kind of mouthfeel. And so what you want to do is, if you've got a lean cut of meat and you've overcooked it and it's gone dry, if it's turkey or chicken or whatever it is, then you want to try and recreate that kind of that luscious gelatin flavor. And so one way to do it is to shred up your meat and put it into a rich gravy, a rich sauce. If you make it into like a fritter, for example, then you get lots of flavorful things in there, lots of fats and oils in there. You can restore some of that smooth mouthfeel. So you want to get the dryness, split it up, shred it up, maybe put it into meatballs or something, so that you're kind of restoring some of this natural kind of the moisture that was there originally.
Talking to Dr. Stuart Faramond, his new book is The Science of Cooking. We're focusing on meat today. Let's talk marinades now. I've been getting into marinades for chicken and pork chops and things like that. And I keep shooting for as long as I possibly can. I feel bad if I only marinate for half an hour. I'm an idiot. I don't need to marinate it that long, it sounds like, reading your book.
No. Rob, you're doing the right thing. The time-shy person is coming up with the best marinades. the word marinade, it originally just meant like a salty soup that you used to preserve meat in. And somehow over the years, it's got turned into this thing that we put on meat and we leave it for a long time, and somehow the flavors infuse all the way through it. But it doesn't actually happen. If you can do experiments, you can get meat and you can submerge it in something. And the liquid, the flavor-filled liquid that you're putting it in, what's your favorite marinade, Rob?
I've come up with this chicken shawarma marinade. I grind cumin and things like that. I'm talking about it all the time. I love this. And it comes out good when I marinate it.
Essentially, when you marinate, you're putting a glaze on the outside of the meat, because that marinade can't get very far into the muscle. As I said, muscle is the meat is 75% to 85% water, so it's like a filled sponge. You can't actually get much more in there. So when you're soaking it in this marinade, it's only going in a few millimeters. So you can leave it in your marinade, leave it overnight, leave it 2 days. It's still never going to get right into the middle. And the danger of leaving it more than a few hours is that the acids that are in your marinade, if you've kind of used some vinegar or some lemon juice or some wine or something like that, they're actually starting to break down the surface meat. So it's going to make it kind of go mealy. It's the same thing that if you ever cook fish ceviche, when you get fish and you slice it up really, raw fish, slice it up really fine, and you put it in some lemon juice, and it actually comes out kind of cooked tasting. That's because acids will cook meat in the same way it does if we were to heat it.
And I wanted to ask you right about a question that I think everybody has. Why do so many things taste like chicken?
Well, there's kind of two reasons behind this. One is the type of muscle that you got with chicken. Normally with chicken, we're thinking of the chicken breast, which is this pale muscle. And that has got, it's called a fast twitch muscle in that it's designed for doing short bursts of activity. So it's the breast muscle. So normally a chicken would be using it to flap its wings. And that kind of muscle doesn't have much red colouring, doesn't have much of a thing called myoglobin, which is what makes meat red. So it doesn't have much flavour from that point of view. It doesn't have much of the flavour-carrying fat. And so essentially, it's quite a bland muscle. So essentially, it's bland. So other bland-tasting meats that are like that, like frog, for example, or pigeon or something like that, it'll taste quite similar because there's not much to distinguish it from other muscles, whereas, say, beef and lamb, they're a different kind of muscle. They're these endurance muscles, and they have a lot more flavour and a lot more character than. But interestingly, scientists have tracked back using genetics to try and work out where the different animals came from. And it seems that most of the animals that we eat came from a now extinct ancestor, which tasted a lot like chicken. So dinosaurs tasted like chicken.
Wow. Like, that makes you think. If only we could try them. We're talking about the science of cooking meat with Dr. Stuart Faramond. He's a food scientist and the author of the book, The Science of Cooking, Every Question Answered to Perfect Your Cooking. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the science of cooking with meat? What is your go-to cut of meat? Do you have any sciencey food questions for Dr. Stu? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation, maybe get your questions coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now with Dr. Stuart Faramond, food scientist and the author of The Science of Cooking. We are focusing on meat. His book covers a lot more than meat. You can call in now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Do you have questions about cooking with meat that science could answer for you? Have you ever wondered what's actually happening to your food when you cook it? Call in with your questions and maybe your ideas. See if they work out or not scientifically. Call in at 800-642-1234. We'll go to our callers now. We've got Philip on the line in Stevens Point. Philip, hi.
Hi, my question is about intentionally aging meat, sometimes to the point where it looks like it may be rotten. I've heard it increases the flavor, it's a desirable thing.
Philip, thanks. Dr. Stu, aging meat?
Well worth doing, really well worth doing. And yes, it will go brown on the outside, and yes, you will get some mold in it quite possibly, but it's something that's doing something that's well worth doing if you want to get flavor out of your meat. Because what's happening is when you age meat, you're letting enzymes within the meat itself do some of the digesting for you. It'll be breaking down the muscle and making it more tender. You can kind of think of it that muscle, when it's alive, it's doing a lot of stuff. It's going through a lot of stress, and it's having to repair itself the whole time. And a part of that repairing process is that there are enzymes in the muscle that break it down so that it can be rebuilt again. But when the animal is dead, they obviously can't be rebuilt, but those enzymes that do the breaking down are still in there. So if you let the meat rest, those enzymes will do some of the breaking down, and after about 14 days, it will be at 80% maximum tenderness. So that's a really good time to leave it for. If you can leave it for longer, that's even better. The trick is to make sure you've got a big bit of meat because it's going to dry out. Put it in the fridge. Make sure put a drip tray underneath it and put some water in that drip tray, and essentially just leave it in there. The water in the drip tray, some of that will evaporate, and that will increase the humidity within your fridge, And so that will stop it drying out a bit. And so go back periodically and check on it. And if there's kind of there's crusts and there's bits of mold on the outside, that's okay, that's normal. When you come to finish, you just want to chop that off. And then the meat inside, it'll still be red inside. It'll be brown on the outside, but it'll be red on the inside. And you have really tender, really beautiful meat on the inside.
I don't know, man. I'm getting a little nervous about meat in my fridge after day four, maybe. How do I know for sure that this meat is just aged and not, you know, hitting rancid / lethal stage?
That's a really, that, well, I would say get your meat from a good quality butcher so that you know the meat's been handled well, and so you're not going to have lots of nasty pathogens on the outside if it's been kind of thrown around some kind of packaging plant before it was slapped in some cellophane. But it's and so that's good so that you're not going to have super nasties on the outside. But essentially, if you've got good quality meat and you put it in your fridge, it should be fine. If you've got any questions, find a friendly butcher and ask them about how they age their meat. They're great people to talk to for finding out tips on aging meat. But give it a go. Give it a go. Make sure you've got a big bit. Don't do it with a steak or something, because it will shrivel up and the moldy bits will end up being more than the meat that's left over, and you'll be really disappointed. So get a big bit of meat. Don't be worrying about that you're going to have to shear off some of the outside, because what's left on the inside will be really good.
Philip, thanks. Hope that helps you out. We'll go next to Daryl on the line in Hayward. Daryl, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
My question is regarding steak tartare. I'd like him to comment on that, because that's raw ground sirloin on dark rye bread. What does he have to say about that?
Daryl, thanks. This is big in certain subcultures in Wisconsin, Dr. Stu. Steak tartare, what do you think?
Hey, Daryl. Yeah, Daryl, I love steak tartare. It's really nice. If you're kind of worried from a sort of a health and safety point of view,
and
then
I am.
Steak is... Then you are. Are you worried, Rob?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's safe. It's fine. It is fine. The thing that I mean, we know, we're told that raw meat is dangerous. But the thing is that the inside of the meat is fine. It's only the outside of the meat that's been exposed to the air and that's got all the bugs on it that is the dangerous bit. When you get to the inside of the meat, that's going to be essentially perfectly sterile. So providing you're not, so if you're using the middle of the meat and you're eating it raw, then it should be absolutely fine. You should always use your senses. So our senses are highly attuned, highly evolved to be able to pick up when something isn't right. If it tastes bitter, then that means that there's something in there. There's maybe some toxins or something in there that bugs happen to have been crawling on it. Don't eat it if it's sticky or slimy or if it doesn't smell good. But if none of those things, it should be perfectly fine.
Daryl, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking about the science of cooking with meat, and we're talking to Dr. Stuart Faramond. His new book is called The Science of Cooking. He covers a lot of kinds of cooking. We're focusing on the meat chapter today. You also write about different kinds of chicken. And when you're at the store, you might see all kinds of different labels on chicken: organic, free range, indoor, outdoor. Does it matter what we buy in terms of what it's going to taste like?
One thing I must say about the raw meat thing is that whereas steaks can be served rare, if your hamburgers are less safe, because hamburgers are made from mince, and so that mince has all been exposed to the air, and so when you're pounding all together, you've essentially got potentially all the outside bits of meat all mushed up on the inside. So you've got to be more cautious with hamburgers, but essentially what I said before holds true. Chicken, yes, they'll try and sell as anything, won't they? Kind of, happy chicken, corn-fed chicken. If you can taste the difference, you're doing well. I'll be honest with you, because I've tried very expensive chicken and cheap chicken, and it's hard to tell the difference apart. But there are differences, there are subtle differences. One thing to bear in mind is that the chickens that we'll eat from today, they're broiler chickens. They're kind of a hybrid bird that has never existed in the wild. And we've bred them so that they're bigger and bigger and bigger. And they produce loads of meat, but it's quite tasteless. The only way if you're going to have really flavorful chicken is to actually go to a heritage breed chicken, one that is actually smaller. They have to live longer before they're killed, because they're slower growing. 50 years ago, the chickens that we were eating then were a quarter of the size of the chickens that we have now. That's how far it's gone. So I would say the breed of the chicken is probably going to be the biggest influence on the flavor that you're going to have from the chicken. But it's quite hard to get hold of a heritage breed chicken, and it's going to cost you a small fortune if you do find it. So short of that, you want to go for the best living conditions possible for your chicken. So stuff that is organic, that's the best marker that you've probably got if you've gone down the supermarket to know whether the chicken has had a good life or not. Because any animal that is stressed or has had a poor life, the meat will be inferior. Organic means that it's had more area to live in. It has access to the outside. They should be down to about 5 chickens per square meter. Whereas if you go for your indoor farmed chicken, which will just be everything that doesn't say otherwise on the packet, then they will put up to 20 chickens in a square meter. That's how they live. It's quite you just have to go onto YouTube and look at the videos to see how unpleasant it is. So I would say go for the best welfare possible. You'll see also corn-fed chicken. Now, that just means that they've been fed corn and they have a slightly different flavour, and the colour of the meat will be slightly more yellow, but it doesn't mean anything about how well it's been kept. So corn-fed could mean that it's been reared in inhumane conditions, but it's just been fed corn. So I would go for welfare secondary to going for a heritage breed if you can get hold of one.
Well, Dr. Stu, we've just scratched the surface. I hope we can talk to you again before too long. Thanks for joining us today.
A pleasure, Rob.
We've been talking to Dr. Stuart Faramond. He's a food scientist and the author of the new book, The Science of Cooking, Every Question Answered to Perfect Your Cooking. We've been focusing here on the science of cooking meat. His book covers a lot more ground than that. There's a lot of veggies and potatoes and starches in there, too. You can head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page, share your favorite recipes or cooking tips while you're there. Again, that's over at the Ideas Network Facebook page.